Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bentley, Judge Larson, Judge Riley, the Honorable Elizabeth Bentley presiding.
Morning, counsel, and welcome to the Court of Appeals. For the audio record, today is June 5th, 2025, and we're holding this argument via Zoom Gov. And an audio re record of today's hearing will be available on the court's website within 24 hours. We have three oral cases on our calendar this morning, and with that, I'll call the first case, which is A24-1771, Christopher Lee Kanakowicz versus State of Minnesota. Good morning, counsel. I have just a couple of housekeeping matters before we get started. So first, the time clock should be visible to you. If you're in gallery view, can you each see the clock?
No.
Okay. Because I think, and I heard, sorry, that you're on your phone. I heard there was a little mix-up today about whether we're in person. So is there a way, I know on your phone, I imagine it's a small screen, but maybe if there's a way to hit gallery or we can try and flag the time for you as we get closer.
I'm not seeing it, Your Honor, but it's probably incompetence. I can I have my watch, so I can know when I'm getting close.
If you have your watch that you can keep an eye out, and I'll give you maybe a couple of minute warning as the time is getting close to expiring.
I appreciate it.
Okay. So second, if I could just ask you both to keep your video on even while you're not arguing, but do please mute your microphone if you're not speaking. And third, just to review the timing for argument, appellant will be given 15 minutes. For the opening argument, respondent will have 15 minutes, and then appellant, you'll have another 5 minutes for rebuttal. So finally, I'll say just please introduce yourself and your client for the record. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you so much. And may it please the court, Daniel Gertz appearing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Konakowicz. I apologize. I'm here in the courthouse in person. I didn't realize it was Zoom, but this should work out. I wanted to focus my remarks initially on the most obvious reason why the district court abused its discretion in denying the relief sought. And that is because it employed the incorrect legal standard for the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim that we raised. It concluded that we had to show that the outcome of the proceeding would have been different, rather than showing merely that there was a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different. And two.
My question about that is, do you need to be successful on your first argument for us to reach that legal question? Meaning it just sort of the idea that we need to remand for a new sentence, is that the prong one? And if prong one isn't met, we don't reach prong two. And so do you need to win on your first issue in order for us to reach that legal question?
I'm not entirely sure I understand the question, but I think the answer
I
is.
can state it better. So I understand that your reason for winning on prong one is that it was ineffective assistance of counsel to not bring this claim regarding the sentence. And our case law says that you can win on ineffective assistance on if either prong isn't met. And so if we disagree with you regarding the post-conviction court's decision regarding the sentence, is that dispositive of your ineffective assistance of counsel claim, or do we need to remand anyway because of the alleged legal mistake?
I have to show that that there would have been and I think I can it makes more sense when I point out that the district court also erred in its factual finding on that basis, because the result almost certainly would would have been different. But both prongs certainly are met. And it is true that if the district court, if the post-conviction court had found that either one prong or the other prong were not met, that I would get no relief. I agree with that. But in this case, there I certainly would have received the relief, and that's based on this court's decision in Mohammed, where it is very clear, the State versus Mohammed, where if this court had seen that case on direct appeal and the same question were presented, that this was an improper basis for the departure, what Mohammed says is, well, we need two things. This court needs two things. One, you have to have a finding of an appropriate circumstance. And two, you need an explanation from the district court as to why that constitutes substantial and compelling reasons. And in that case, it said this. It says, from our careful review of the record, we cannot discern the weight given to the invalid factors as compared to the valid factor. Consequently, the record does not permit us to conclude that the district court would have imposed the same sentence based on the valid aggravating factor. And they have
Counsel, doesn't the fact that the Muhammad case is a direct appeal seems to really distinguish it from this one, right? Because here we do have a record. It's on post-conviction, or at least a statement by the same judge who sentenced your client that it would have been the same. So it seems like our record here is different. There on direct appeal, the Court of Appeals wouldn't have any way to know because there's no other further analysis by the district court. So why doesn't that kind of move us into at least a different space where here at least the record we have more information about what the district court would have done?
Well, two answers to that question. The first answer is no, we don't have more information now. And second, the question for the court or the district court, the post-conviction court and this court concerns what would have happened on a direct appeal. And so we have to look at how this court would have approached a direct appeal. And if this court would have remanded for resentencing on a direct appeal, then the post-conviction court is just plain wrong in its fact-finding as well as its legal standard. As to the first question, that we don't have more information, we simply don't. What the co the first time around, the court did not explain the reasoning for its departure. It identified two potential departures, and it gives us actually a pretty good clue that it didn't really put much weight on the second factor. That's on page 15 of the transcript, where the district court goes into depth into why the age is a, quote, an appropriate aggravating factor. And then just in passing notes that there was another issue that this started while these kids were asleep. And it says, and again, that is a basis for a departure, but that does not even characterize that as an appropriate basis. This time
Well, so I
around, we
guess I
don't.
want to just to go back to my question. What I'm wondering is what is the record when we talk about when we're on post-conviction appeal like this? You're looking at the record, the sentencing record, right?
Yes.
And I'm what I, my question is whether we can consider what the district court said in its post-conviction order as
Well,
part of the record before us as to whether or not it would have been a different sentence. Because and I guess my question is, do you know of a case that says that we can't do that or that defines what the record is? Because in my research, it looks like we've done that, where we do look at what the district court says on post-conviction as to what they might have done.
yeah, except in this case, it doesn't say that. In this, what we have to do here is determine whether there was an abuse of discretion. That's the issue for the court. If the post-conviction court has said, you know, looking at these factors now, if I had only had the one appropriate factor before me and not the obviously invalid factor, I think I would have imposed the same sentence or something very similar to it. The court did not say that. It said simply that had the court not taken the improper factor into consideration, The departure would have been supported. In other words, it looked at it not as what it how it would have approached a sentencing using just the proper factor, but that the result that we ended up with cannot be attacked because if that had been the case, it would have been justified. But of course, it was not the case. And that's the problem we have here is that well, at the original sentencing, the district court apparently took both factors into consideration. We don't know the weight given to one or the other. The post-conviction court said, well, if it had not considered the inappropriate reason, then the one remaining reason would have supported the sentence. But it did not say, and I don't think it could say that the sentence would have been the same. And that's the point I think you're getting to, Your Honor, is that if the court had said I would have imposed the same sentence, then we would be left with a situation where, in fact, we wouldn't be able to get to both of those prongs on Strickland, and the sentence presumptively would be appropriate. But the fact that the post-conviction court did not say that is extremely important. And we can tell from the original sentencing record, looking at the post-conviction record, that that would not have been the result had the court actually sentenced using just appropriate aggravating circumstances. Glancing at my watch to find out how close
You're
I
about
am.
five and a half minutes
Okay.
to go.
I have kind of an analogous question, and this is just a thing that I've been struggling with. So we have a number of cases, we have a number of precedential cases where the question has been, was the upward departure appropriate? And the district court used, two or three bases for an upward departure. One of those bases was maybe questionable in terms of its support in the record, and our court has therefore analyzed one factor, said this one factor would be enough to support the upward departure, and affirmed on that ground. And that body of cases to me seems somewhat in tension with Muhammad and this concept of if one of them was not appropriate, then it needs to be clear in the record that the sentence would be the same. Have you been able to find in your research any case law that has I have not, but has sort of reconciled those two areas of law? Because to me, there seems to be some tension there, given that we have case law that says we can affirm an upward departure based on one supportable basis.
Well, this court can affirm a departure based on one aggravated circumstance, but only if that aggravated circumstance in the context of the case does indeed support the departure and the range of the departure that was granted. Usually, the court can make that determination by looking at the sentencing transcript and determining what weight the district court may have given it, the explanation for why it constitutes a substantial and compelling reason, and based on that, make its own determination that yes, the district court could have done this. It is appropriate in this case, and based on the circumstances of this case, we think it is reasonable and a just conclusion. Here.
Mr. Gertz, do you think it makes a difference that the trial judge, sentencing judge, is the same as the post-conviction judge?
I think it's especially telling in this case that the post-conviction judge did not say I would have imposed the same sentence.
Except he did. I mean, by implication, since he did impose the same sentence,
Well, I strongly disagree with that because he did not say that, and he was careful in his wording to say, had this been the only reason, it would have supported the departure. That's not saying that he would have imposed the same thing, just saying that as a legal matter, had the court only considered one of these, we would not need to be here. We
Can't we
don't.
infer from the fact that the post-conviction judge didn't grant relief that the district court judge looked at this case and said, I would have imposed the same sentence? I'm like, why can't we make that inference?
Well, we can't make that inference because the court did not say that. The only way that if the court wants to impose the same sentence, this court should remand it for that determination, and he can impose the same sentence. But we can't just guess that. Well, it looks like he might have imposed the same sentence because he's not angry enough about or disappointed enough about the result to have given us some relief in this post-conviction case. I mean, this court can't guess about it like that. If the court wants, if the court thinks that it's appropriate for the district court to have that shot at it, it should remand, and then we're entitled to argue about all the reasons why that lone factor may or may not support the departure actually given, or why it should be different.
So just sorry to interrupt. You're down to 1 minute. I have one question just on a little bit on that point about kind of thinking about what a remand might look like in this case. Would the court here denied the petition without an evidentiary hearing, if I'm remembering correctly? Would you do you think an evidentiary hearing is necessary here for the post-conviction, or is your position that even just on the face of it should be a grant of a post-conviction petition that would get remanded for resentencing?
Well, I think the district court erred in not having an evidentiary hearing in the first place, because when you have a situation like this where you have ineffective assistance, and the district court is merely guessing about what the result of a proper assistant would have achieved, that a hearing would have shed a lot more light on that. We could have talked about Muhammad, what this court would have done on a direct appeal, and why the result would have been different. So it should have had that hearing. We're asking for the court simply to, well, at the very least, remand for a new sentencing hearing so that these issues can be resolved.
Thank you, counsel. That is your 15 minutes. So, unless there are further questions at this point, we'll turn counsel for respondent. You may begin your argument when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Jill Green, and I represent the state of Minnesota. Which is the respondent in this matter. The issue before this court is obviously whether the district court abused its discretion in denying the post-conviction petition. And I want to set this matter in the context of Mr. Konikowicz's myriad of cases. At sentencing, the state was, its first argument was a request for a double upward departure, and the court imposed that 50% upward departure. But its alternative request was for permissible consecutive sentencing in this matter alone, which would have totaled 204 months. The court did actually depart to 210 months, but I think it's important for this court to note in considering whether the result of the proceeding would have been different or whether the court would have imposed the same sentence, that the court could have not used any of the departing factors found by the jury to impose a permissible consecutive sentence. I think it's also important for this court to note in determining whether counsel was ineffective on appeal that Mr. Konikowicz was all is also serving significant sentences in two other criminal sexual conduct matters. And so I would guess, and I think the district court guessed this as well, that that came into their minds about whether or not it would be worth it or it would be futile to pursue this type of appeal. The first thing I want to
I
address.
mean, those seem like arguments that would be relevant at a resentencing hearing. How does that help us in this moment? I mean, what I'm, looking at is the sentencing transcript, also this order that we have from post-conviction, which is the record in this case. It seems like venturing out into whether there are other sentences or might the district court have like what was the court's thinking in not imposing consecutive sentences? Is starting to kind of go into the realm of speculation on our part, don't you think?
I agree with Your Honor. I just wanted to note that for the record, when this court is considering, well, can we infer from the district court not making a very explicit finding that it would have imposed the same sentence? Obviously, this court doesn't have the benefit of appearing in front of this judge, and this isn't part of the record, but I know this judge would have, if he felt that this sentence would have been different, would have granted post-conviction relief. Regardless, his order, even though it did not contain that specific particular language that the defense is focusing on, I think it is very easily inferable that he would have imposed the same sentence. And you can see that in the sentencing transcript and in the order itself. The order itself states that had the district court not considered that, had the victim's ages not been taken into consideration, the fact that they were particularly vulnerable because they were asleep when the defendant sexually assaulted them would have justified the departure in this case. The district court then found the result of the proceeding would not have been different. The district court then further found that the durational departure in this case is justified by the independent ground of particular vulnerability due to being asleep. All of those findings innately mean that the district court would have imposed the same sentence. I also disagree with appellant that the district court imposed the wrong standard. The district court cited the correct standard, reasonable probability, in its argument or in its order. And additionally, if the court found that something would not have been different, it's also innately finding that something is not likely to have been different. So I think that's a parsing of words that is inaccurate. I don't think the district court used an erroneous legal standard, and I think that it's shown by its citation in the record. So the state in this matter would ask this court to affirm the district court's denial of the petition on its face.
I have a question with regard, I mean, it kind of piggybacks on Judge Bentley's questions that she was asking appellant. The way I see this case is we have two grounds that have been considered. Is we have one, was this an illegal sentence, which can be brought up at post-conviction anytime? And then we have ineffective assistance of counsel. And to me, I think that the record that we're looking at, depending upon which of those claims is different, I think that in the illegal sentence context, the post-conviction court is reviewing that sort of in the first instance, whereas the ineffective assistance, I think that we do sort of need to look back at what might have happened during the appeal. Do you agree with that, or am I sort of misunderstanding what we're looking at in terms of those two claims?
When I was looking at the legal standard, which is, you know, there's the two prongs that you now analyze in determining whether or not appellate counsel was ineffective. It simply states whether or that the issue is whether there is a reasonable probability that the result would have been different. It doesn't say anything about who or that the Court of Appeals would have been different or the district court would have been different. I think in this case, the district court interpreted it, and I also interpreted it to mean that the sentence would have been different. So would it have been different for the would it have been different if the respondent had, if the respondent's appellate counsel had said, nope, this is an unlawful sentence. This court said, no, vacate it, send it back to the district court. The court said, nope, I would have imposed the same sentence. So I think the court said, nope, the end result of the entire proceeding would have been the same, which is that the other factor justifies this departure. And so I apologize if I'm not making sense, but
No, that's helpful. I'm really trying to tease out, I mean, do you see this all as an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim, or do you see there being two separate claims? One is the, you know, the general standard that we have where you can challenge an illegal sentence at every time. He's challenging that this is an illegal sentence that entitles him to a new sentencing hearing, and fact and argument two, separate and apart from that, I received ineffective assistance of counsel because that argument should have been raised in direct appeal. I shouldn't have had to raise that. And I guess I'm just trying to tease out if you think that those are different or if this is really one big umbrella ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
Frankly, I guess I haven't really considered it in that matter, in that way, Your Honor. To me, it was two separate issues because that's how it was raised.
I mean, that's how I see it also. And I just wanted to see if you thought that the lens with which we look at those claims is any different, because in one of them, the post-conviction court is sitting sort of as the first decision maker on whether or not this was an illegal sentence. And in the other one, you know, the post-conviction court is looking and saying, was there ineffective assistance in our proceeding below? And it sounds to me like, regardless, you think that we need to be looking at the post-conviction court's statements regarding whether or not a new sentence would be imposed, is what I hear you saying.
Yes, and I think it's all, I agree with you. I think it's a little convoluted, and it's all dependent on this post-conviction petition saying that one departure ground was unlawful. But I think appellant's entire argument hinges on his argument that the second factor in and of itself is not enough to justify the sentence. And that's what the district court looked at when determining A, is the sentence unlawful, and B, would the result of the proceeding have been different? And the district court, for example, the district court found that the result of the proceeding would not have been different. And again, if he found that it would not have been different, there is therefore not a reasonable probability that the result would have been different. But also, when you look at State v. Mohammed, it considers whether the district court would have imposed the same sentence absent reliance upon the improper aggravating factor. But then it says, in doing so, the court considers the weight given to the invalid factor and when are there any remaining factors found by the court independently justify the departure. The district court clearly found that the other factor independently justify the departure. With respect to the weight given to the invalid factor, I agree that you could then consider that the district court essentially stated that it would have imposed the same sentence because if it had given improper weight to the unlawful sentencing factor, then it would have found that the sentence itself was invalid. And I know this is a little bit of circular reasoning, but the district court did in its sentencing transcript state specifically that both of the departing factors found by the jury on their own supported a departure. And similarly, it found that in its order denying relief. So I think it all hinges on, I apologize. I think it all hinges on whether or not appellant can prove that this independent factor does not justify departure. And I don't think he's done that. I would ask that this court affirm the district court's denial of the petition. If this court does remand, I don't see the purpose of an evidentiary hearing. It sounds like the speculation is what the district court would have done. However, unless they were planning to call the judge as a witness, I'm not sure how that would have been sussed out through an evidentiary hearing. I think the district court can decide this matter based upon the record. And if there is a remand, it can impose the presumptive sentence, or the state can still argue for consecutive permissible sentencing on its case, which would be 204 months. So for all the reasons written in the brief, I would ask that this court affirm the district court's denial. And unless there are other questions, I would rely on my brief.
Thank you, counsel. Looks like there are no other questions. Mr. Gertz, we'll put 5 minutes back on the clock here, and I'll be happy to, if you want to mark your watch, but I'll otherwise give you a warning at the last minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. There were two issues I wanted to respond to in counsel's argument. The first one is the precise issue on the ineffective assistance side of the appeal is whether appellate counsel was ineffective, not whether trial counsel was ineffective. Appellate counsel was ineffective because it didn't raise the issue that trial counsel apparently forgot to raise or was not aware of. And if the result in that proceeding, meaning this court on direct appeal, would have been different, then we win. I mean, and the result would have been different if you look at Mohammed and what it tells this court to do. The result The actual result in direct appeal was simply affirming everything. But this court, if it did what Mohammed tells this court to do, most certainly would have had to remand for resentencing had the issue been raised. And
I feel like that's a, and maybe this is getting back to what Judge Larson is trying to figure out, is there a difference between the two claims? And it seems like if we're going down that route where we're looking at the ineffective assistance of counsel claim in a vacuum of only looking at the sentencing hearing, and we can't consider the post-conviction court's statements, then that's a different question, it sounds like, than what we're talking about with the, like, if the post-conviction court were deciding in the first instance. Or do you, is there a difference between those two arguments that you're making, that the ineffective, we're more like focused in the record that we can look at, but on the post-conviction kind of direct claim challenge to the sentence, we can look at those statements?
Well, the claims are different. They're obviously very related because the ineffective assistance claim is based on the fact that this the sentence was the departure was based on an invalid factor, and everybody agrees that that was an invalid factor. The question was, well, how much weight did the sentencing court give that invalid factor? Would the sentence have been different had it not considered that invalid factor? And the post-conviction court didn't answer that question. It simply said, well, had only one factor been considered, that's legal support sufficient to uphold the sentence. But that doesn't answer the question of what sentence would have been appropriate had only the legal factors been considered.
Well, the question the district court was faced with on issue one is whether your client received an illegal sentence. And the district court ultimately said no, because even if you omitted the improper factor, the second factor would have supported the same sentence. Therefore, the sentence was not illegal, right? I mean, that's, and so what I'm trying to figure out is, once the district court has done the analysis that we would normally, right, normally that is the analysis that would be conducted in the direct appeal, whether or not it was an illegal sentence. That's the Mohammed analysis. Now, when we move to ineffective assistance of counsel, and the question is whether the appellate counsel's performance did not meet an objective standard of reasonableness because they didn't raise that issue, why isn't the district court right that it didn't meet the objective standard of reasonableness if in the first issue the post-conviction court is determining that the sentence wasn't illegal?
Well, you're missing one point, and that is that whether the sentence is illegal is one issue. Whether the court would have imposed the same sentence is a different issue. And that's what Mohammed addresses. And Mohammed says, whether it would have been legal or not, we have to know how the court would have ruled had it only taken into account valid legal reasons for a departure. And that's why it required a remand to let the district court make that decision in the first instance.
And that's the issue one question, right? That's not the ineffective assistance of counsel question, as I understand it. That's the, did he receive an unlawful sentence? Because my recollection of Mohammed, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, my recollection of Mohammed was that that was a direct appeal where they challenged the legality of the sentence. Or am I just getting my cases confused?
Yeah, they challenged the departure because it was based on improper factors. I think there were three in that case. One was valid, two were not valid. And so the Court of Appeals had to send it back for a determination of what the sentence would have been, considering just the legal basis, because there was no appropriate record for them to know which way the district court would have gone. And in this case, the sentencing court did not say, contrary to what counsel just said, that the sentence would have been supported by either reasons for departure. It did not say that, And I guess we can't know for sure, but just looking at the record, it looks like it put more weight on the invalid factor than on the valid factor. I suspect I'm getting close to my limit.
Yeah, you've gone a bit over, but that's that was in good response to questions. So thank you for your argument. Both of you, the case has been submitted, and we will issue an order within the time prescribed by statute. Thanks very much.